some time on 3D quantum gravity. We have 1 hour for 4D quantum gravity. So the nice thing is that basically, at least concerning loop quantum gravity, most of the stuff you have learned applies to also to 4D. So basically, there are also flux operators. And as I mentioned, they are now associated to surfaces, which are, however, also dual to edges of a spin network graph. And these flux operators act in the same way as in 3D. And then in 3D, we had basically that this was giving you the length of the dual curve. So this will give you actually the area square of surface dual to the edge, E. So that means that if you consider a surface, then any edge going through the surface will give you a contribution to this area, which is given basically by the square. And as before, that will be a Casimir, and everything is still basically an SU2. So these are SU2 valued operators. And so for the holonomies, these will be also the usual holonomies, and you have the same holonomy, flux algebra, and so on. So they are associated to these edges, E. and as before, we get spin networks. As in 3D, we basically have spin networks which are labeled by intertwiners. Now, sorry, representation labels. As I will explain you in a minute, it's basically what one needs to have useful states, useful meaning encoding something like a three-dimensional geometry. One needs forward and vertices. And a four-valent vertex, you in principle need to specify an intertwiner for these representations. And as I told you, this intertwiner we will discuss in a minute will be just given by a representation label again. So let's look at these vertices or at the geometry these things encode. So now we basically have a three-dimensional 3D space. And so in fact, the idea is that now basically you have a tetrahedron or some other polygon, but the smallest thing you can think of is a kind of tetrahedron. And you can draw the stuff which is dual to a tetrahedron in 3D. And that will be a four-valent vertex which sits inside the tetrahedron. And you have edges which basically go through the surface. And they would go to the next tetrahedron, next tetrahedra here. so then, now, so it's different than in 3D, you see. Now, basically, we have these representation labels, which in geometry-wise sit on the triangles of this tetrahedron and specify the area of these triangles. And so you actually have just four triangles with area. And you see that there's already the first, actually it turns out rather important difference to 3D, that if you have four triangles, however, a tetrahedron is specified by six length variables. So you might wonder, where are these six length variables? Where are these six additional variables? And in fact, it turns out that what you need also to specify is this intertwiner. And the intertwiner for a four-valent vertex, as I explained to you, comes basically from kind of deciding to choose some expansion scheme for this four-valent vertex, and then coupling first two and then the other two of these spans. So you have this virtual edge and another intertwiner, another representation label. And so you have to decide on this expansion scheme. And actually, it turns out that what you can also consider is basically, if you would consider classical geometry, what you can also consider is basically the dihedral angles of a tetrahedron, which would be defined by the angle between the normals to the triangles of this tetrahedron. That's defined to be the dihedral angle. And so the dihedral angles would, together with the areas, would certainly specify the six length variables. But here you have six dihedral angles. Actually, if you have also the four triangle areas, there turn out to be only two independent dihedral angles. And which dihedral angle you get of these two depends on basically the recoupling scheme you are choosing. And in a certain way, to go from this recoupling scheme to this recoupling scheme, actually, you need a linear combination. I mean, it's a basis transformation, which where the coefficients or where the unitary transformations are given by these six J symbols. And that will give you the other angle. And actually, that means that you cannot actually specify both angles at the same time. And in fact, basically, for these two dihedral angles, one kind of finds, if I remember correctly, one finds basically also some classical Poisson brackets, which tell you that they don't commute. So in 3D, we found that we can specify the spatial geometry sharply in 2 plus 1. In 3 plus 1, this is not anymore the case. And in fact, there's subtle differences between the naive simplicial geometry here and the loop quantum gravity geometry. And one is actually that here already the spatial geometry in itself has this funny fuzziness. And you see that basically in the, this arises basically because of the non-commutativity of the fluxes. And in 3D, it wasn't important in 2 plus 1, but here in 4D, it leads to this feature. And it certainly has certain repercussions for the interpretation of the theory and of the geometry and it encodes. But nevertheless, you can basically define operators like area volume and length modulo these problems with a fuzzy geometry in the sense that it's a generalized geometry, so one needs to define what one actually means with this length. And the picture you get of quantum geometry is busy quite different of the picture you would get in an approach called ratchet geometry, where you would kind of have a classical sharp geometry, at least for a spatial slice. So basically, this general stuff basically would define you the kinematical area. So basically, all the rules and things we discussed in 3D also apply to 4D. And we would have these spin network states with the same inner product and so on. And that would basically be the first step. And the second step would be basically considering the constraints. And of course, yes, this problem that this step is much more complicated than in 2 plus 1. And so we have the Gauss constraints, which we basically already solved by looking at gauge invariant states. There's a diffeomorphism constraint, which is spatial diffeomorphism. And this can be also solved by a kind of abstract procedure. But the main key point is the Hamiltonian constraint, where there's a strategy to solve it. And let's discuss these constraints. Certainly, a difficulty is that one has to basically find kind of a quantization of these constraints. And the difficulty is in the fact that both the diffeomorphism constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint, we cannot rewrite it as in 2 plus 1 into just flatness, which would commute, but we really have to work with the diffeomorphism constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint. And compared to the kind of Hamiltonians which one knows, and for instance, Young-Mills, these constraints are quite difficult. Because they are complicated. Be complicated combinations of the fluxes and the connections. So that would be the connection. And the diffeomorphism constraint would be a contraction of your fluxes with the curvature. So it's not that all curvature is vanishing. And the Hamiltonian constraints is actually the different cases. It used to be quite simple. Because in the original formulation, it was basically just this part if one actually multiplies it with the square root of q. The problem is basically that this original formulation, so here you have an epsilon, here you have two fluxes, and you have an f, and everything is contracted with each other in the right way. The difficulty with this formulation, where you only had basically this part, was that to get this part to be zero, you had to choose this to be -1, which meant that this parameter had to be I, and that parameter is now known as Emirzi parameter or Barbero-Emirzi parameter. And choosing this equal to gamma equal to plus minus I means actually that one works with a gauge group or with holonomies which are in SL2C. So you get complex valued stuff. And technically, it's hard, or it kind of nobody really managed to define really a rigorous Hilbert space for SL2C. And even if one manages this, which would be very interesting, one still has to actually worry about implementing so-called reality conditions, which kind of make everything again real. And then it turns out that the reality condition are basically the same as the simplicity constraints, which I will mention in a minute, and are crucial to the spin form approach. in any case, these are kind of the classical expression. So this is a kind of, this is called H Lorentzian, because actually this term, as it is here, appears in this form for Lorentzian signature. For Euclidean signature, you can actually choose gamma equal to +1. And this term vanishes. So actually, I should have put here a signature of spacetime. And this Lorentzian term, in any case, it's even more complicated because it involves something called extrinsic curvature, which one has to define via the spin connection. And the spin connection is itself a complicated function of the triads. But there's a trick to actually find to simplify this expression using Poisson brackets. So in principle, one can quantize these constraints. But the difficulty is that actually what one would have is to also represent the algebra. And the algebra now is much more complicated. So this one would actually smear with a so-called shift function, vector field. And then if one would check the algebra, then modulo these conventions, which is a sign. Oh. The algebra of diffeomorphisms is actually a nice Lie algebra because it's just the Lie algebra of vector fields on this manifold. Apparently, I have a minus sign here. The algebra between the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism is also simple in the sense that it just tells you that the Hamiltonian is a scalar density, which you can integrate with some scalar, which is a Lebesgue function. And so it says that this is the Lie derivative with respect to this vector field of your scalar density. And this Lie derivative is actually just the partial derivative of the scalar. What is more complicated is, that's the annoying part, is a Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonians. And that is given by a diffeomorphism. And this diffeomorphism depends basically on the phase space variables in the sense that so two Hamiltonians give you a diffeomorphism that's similar to two booths giving you a rotation. But the problem is that here we have the inverse metric appearing. And so we have this new feature that we really have a structure function in our algebra, which depends on the phase space variables, because that's just the dynamical three metric which we are supposed to quantize. And the difficulty was always in basically dating back to all approaches to quantum gravity to represent this algebra. It has a nice geometric interpretation, as you can read in the script. but to have something like a structure function and to figure out factor ordering and so on in the right way is even difficult in the continuum. And in the discrete, the problem is actually that it tends to break diffeomorphism symmetry for sure. So also, there is a quantization of the constraints available. It's basically hard to deal with it. And such a representation of this algebra has not been achieved yet. And the other question is, if one can actually achieve that via these constraints, because of a difficulty I will explain in a minute. So what does one do? There is actually the thing that the constraints are just, are there to specify what are the physical states. And as we discussed, what we usually did also in 3D is to sometimes even avoid the implementation of the constraints. For instance, the Gauss constraint, we just figured out what are the transformations generated by the constraints. And let's find states which are invariant of the constraints by applying this funny operator, which was even group averaging in this case. This is, and basically the idea is to proceed in this way. The group averaging, is basically now the averaging over the transformations which are generated by the constraints. In the case of the Hamiltonian constraints and diffeomorphism constraints, these constraints generate time evolution. And so actually the thing which generates is supposed to give me time evolution is or the time evolution operator that's defined to be the path integral. And so one can actually make a more, it's very heuristic now, but one can derive that really, not rigorously, but formal, that delta C for a totally constrained system ends up to be a path integral. And here it's actually basically one sees the importance that in principle it would be something like NC, which we had for the parameterized particle. And one would have to integrate over both positive and negative shift here, laps. So this need for different time orientation, you see it here. And basically this integral one can actually rewrite into the path integral, which works with an action. And the action depends on some variables x. And so you integrate over all these configuration variables x you have in your system. And the unusual thing is that usually one thinks of a path integral as defining a unitary operator. But in fact, in systems with gauge symmetries, this path integral, if it's kind of constructed in the right way, which is, of course, a difficulty, should be a projector onto physical states. And projectors, to be understood in this also generalized sense of projectors as we had in the flatness, in the case of flatness constraints. Okay, so then the idea is, let's forget about the constraints at the moment. Let's actually just, or let's try to construct this path integral. And here, of course, the problem is that path integral in itself, people try to make more and more sense out of it. But for quantum field theory, one could claim that originally the only really well understood or mathematical rigorous cases were basically actually topological field theories where one could define stuff so that they don't depend on the discretization. So the general difficulty is really making sense out of this measure, which is written with this curly D. And so usually this is achieved with a discretization. And so that kind of, you could say, was hugely successful because it generated a huge community. For instance, in Lattice QCD. And so we have seen one example of a path integral in 3D. And so the idea in 4D would be similar. So in 3D, we had actually that we had basic building blocks, and we associated an amplitude to this basic building block, which happened to be the 6J symbol. And if you want to have something more complicated, then you take your manifold, which should be 3D, and I can't draw, and you discretize it in little tetrahedra, and you sum over bulk variables. And let's define this to be basically the path integral. And in doing this in 3D, one might ask, OK, but now here I choose to make lots of choices. The one thing I choose is a triangulation. And it turns out that 3D is so nice, I didn't quote you about it. But it's invariant under local moves, under local changes of the triangulation. And this invariance comes about because of very nice properties of these 6J symbols, which actually one can explain in very abstract categorical terms. But it's basically, no. There's a move which replaces 3 tetrahedra with 2 tetrahedra, and one move where you basically subdivide a tetrahedra. You can draw that this is actually for one tetrahedra. And basically, there's a nice identity called Beanhahn-Elliott identity, which indeed gives you invariance under these moves. And this actually follows from a certain orthogonality version. Orthogonality of the 6J of 6J symbols. In any case, it turns out that this path integral does not depend on this choice of triangulation. It only depends on this topology of the manifold here. And so you get consistent results. And the other consistent result you get is that modulo the point that you get an infinity, it is also a projector. And this triangulation independence turns out to be very much related to diffeomorphism symmetry. so actually, one can even make this argument that Changing moves here corresponds to an implementation of this constraint algebra. So that was a 4D story and a 3D story. And in 4D, one could say, let's try a similar thing. And here we take a 4 simplex, which is a bit hard to draw, but it's 5 vertices with every vertex connected to every other vertex. And that the surface of this 4 simplex is a 3 sphere glued from 4, 5 tetrahedra. And so we kind of, again, the idea would be, okay, if you manage to associate an amplitude here, which defines you a spin form model, let's define a kind of provisionary path integral, and that is the same like gluing lots of simplices together and putting them in a triangulation. In principle. And so this idea is very nice, and there's, however, one difficulty which now arises here. So this was a topological field theory, and that's the reason, in the end, why kind of discretizing does not matter. And in fact, your discretization can be as large as it wants. If you do lattice QCD, what you usually try, you know, is to avoid discretization artifacts. So your lattice constant you have to choose it reasonably fast, small, sorry. Where whatever that means depends on the problem you consider, and it should be much smaller than the relevant phenomena you consider in your lattice. Now, if you do quantum gravity, there's no fixed lattice constant. The problem is if you even, you know, you choose a, whatever, very fine triangulation, but every simplex in it, let me draw like just a tetrahedron, you sum over all the j's here, which give you the size, and can be, you know, huge. So here the problem is actually that it's basically very hard to, or it's, yeah, it's very hard a priori to say, okay, I discretize, maybe I make some mistake on small distances, because your amplitude is actually defined for all distances. And actually the problem would be, if you want to have really the correct amplitude, it needs to be the exact one for really large distances. And this is very hard to guess. It's basically, you need to actually incorporate also the renormalization flow in case you, for instance, couple matter. of all meta fields which are there, and I hope you have learned that typically you have these flows of coupling constants, for instance. And actually, it's both a kind of, you know, it has a devil's side and has a good side, because you can say, yeah, but I can make a prediction already about huge distances, because I can just choose the j's to be large. But on the other hand, it basically tells you there's this difficulty in basically writing something exact, writing the exact answer for all. Actually, that's called perfect discretization. For all length scales at once. There's one thing which applies, and this is if you actually have your boundary in your manifold, then there's certainly a notion of, if you fix the boundary data here, there's certainly a notion which you can apply, which is about the size of this boundary. And more precisely, it's also variation of the geometry inside your boundary given with the size. And so what you can actually hope, indeed, is fixing here basically a boundary geometry. You can hope that you basically can refine stuff in the bulk sufficiently, and you would get a reliable answer by computing the path integral here, which of course in practice is slightly difficult. But if you really have very simple boundary geometry here, which for instance, would be quite homogeneous, then you can hope you get the same answer despite, say, in the bulk, you sum over all kinds of huge things in between. At some point, you might hope that, in fact, your answer stabilizes by basically taking the refinement limit here. How much you need to go is really how much your result still changes depends on certainly the complexity of your geometry here. And so, in fact, what happens if you take kind of the bare and a particular local amplitudes you started with? And you can basically check whether this thing is a projector. That's why it's called provisionary. So is this true even modulo an infinity? And the answer a priori is not true. However, there's this trick which you can do to have something which you believe might be a projector modulo some details. So let's call that P. In fact, if it exists, then you can make a formal argument that it in fact should satisfy this equation, because 2 times infinity is certainly infinity. And in fact, what you are doing here is basically instead of time, you know, here you have a boundary geometry, and here you have a boundary geometry, and it's 1D, and you integrate your path integral, and that would define your P. But then you take this result and stack it like lots of times behind each other. And so that seems to be kind of a very cumbersome way to compute that. But in fact, there's a nicer way to compute that, and that is basically this is kind of P1. Then you integrate out one subdivision, and this defines your P2. And then you take P2 two P2s and define P3. And so you go on. And what you actually defined here is a nice kind of renormalization flow, actually. So here you would basically do these things together in a, by integrating over the variables here. And in fact, you hope that this converges. And in fact, it does in one-dimensional toy systems. It gives you one way to calculate the path integral, and it's a more interesting way, and it actually also gives you kind of flowing of coupling constants. And of course, it's a more effective way because you don't integrate, I mean, you can calculate how many subdivisions you need to integrate out. If you do it this way, you of course use, for instance, that you already integrated out this thing here, and you already use it, this result, for every second intersection here. And so you save an exponential amount of time, basically. So in fact, this strategy would be sufficient to get a global projector. And one could try this, and you get this funny global projector. You can hope. Unfortunately, that would only apply if you really just have a kind of rigid time translation symmetry. So here we actually want to have much more. We want to have invariance under all kinds of choosing your time hypersurface. And so in fact, if you go to field theory, and have a general boundary, the problem will be that you, if you glue lots of these things together, your boundary gets also more complicated. And so actually, you could think, oh, it just gets bigger, but in fact, size is not the issue here. It's really that it gets more complicated and has more data. And this is what does not happen in 1D, actually, because there's only kind of a point in this boundary, and so at least the discretization of a point is a point. Discretization of something which is 1D is already more complicated because you can basically put 8 vertices in it, or 16, or 32, or something. but in fact, this tells you something related to this. It's important to fix the geometry, and maybe it's also important to think how to basically embed, how to get back here to less complicated geometries or less complicated boundaries. And basically one strategy is actually you take something a priori that is a kind of simple boundary, and in fact, you know, you kind of try to take the discretize it. So that you reach the, I mean, as much as possible in a sense. What will happen is that near the boundary, the stuff necessarily remains a bit coarser, but you don't really care about it too much. But here you should also take the refinement limit. And this you define basically as the amplitude of this actually associated to this boundary. So now, in fact, the hope is that indeed, I mean, firstly, under refinement, if you refine more, that the result will basically converge to something which at some point stabilizes and you are happy with kind of change, which at some point in the refinement process might be so small that you say, okay, I don't care anymore. And you get these amplitudes, which then are reasonably independent, at least, of this bulk triangulation. Well, okay, what can you do with this? Stuff. The point is, of course, now we can go on and ask, how do I get my amplitude for more complicated geometries? Or for more complicated boundaries. Then you would actually a priori kind of repeat this process with a more complicated boundary here. So you would go up to a more complicated triangulation, which actually you already see here. So let's see, you get a result. And you basically define a second amplitude function for a more complicated boundary. However, more complicated means actually that it's a finer graph, for instance, in the case of Ashtika-Lewandowski. And what is important, what one should realize is that kind of coarse graphs, in this case, configurations on coarse graphs you can embed into configurations of finer graphs. In the case of Ashtika-Lewandowski, we said, okay, if you have a coarse graph and you draw additional edges, you would have also always to put j equal to 0 there. To make this concept useful, however, all answers you get from basically applying operators should be such that they agree after refinement, before and after refinement. So in the case of the area or length operator, we have seen that because j equal to 0 gives 0 length. It doesn't matter if you add like lots of j equal to 0 things. So that applies to the length operator. But a priori, or to the area operator in 4D, a priori doesn't need to apply to these amplitudes. So the amplitudes also just give you numbers. And you could basically take this complicated result, at this answer here, and find basically this amplitude for general configuration of the boundary and put the use this embedding map to actually compute the boundary, the amplitude you would have for a less complicated configuration. And what you actually want is that the answers should agree. So actually you want basically that something like this holds. And it looks like a very innocent condition. But it's a very strong condition. Which actually also would tell you that if this holds, that in principle, if that holds, it's sufficient. If you want to know something, a coarse answer, sufficient to look at the coarse boundary. And then you don't get any, you know, corrections from looking at finer graphs. So it would make your life extremely simple. So these would basically actually mean that you already have effective actions. They're all effects which could basically be there due to finer graphs are already in the answer for the coarser boundary. What we haven't specified yet, or realized, or used, is actually that we can choose the embedding. So Arsticker-Lewandowski is a very specific embedding, which is actually not a good embedding, because it says, okay, where there's no edge, there's j equal to 0. And you have a completely, you know, very funny geometry. In fact, what you want to have is that you put actually on these edges, which you don't, you know, the stuff which you don't specify is basically stuff you don't want to care about. Stuff we don't care about, actually, we care deeply about it, is actually the things in the vacuum. So it's actually what we always do in quantum field theory if you kind of assume, you know, if you write zero, that's a vacuum. It's a hugely complicated state, actually. But we manage to not think about it because we manage to just organize our computation so that we only think about excited states, which kind of are called k at some point. So the point is that you want to choose the embedding so that it gives you something like a vacuum state. The vacuum state, as I've seen in 3D, we actually calculated kind of the vacuum state. You get actually at the point I told you that we computed something like the Hartle-Hawking state. You know, the vacuum state would be really the stuff you associate to having no triangulation there. And it would be something like the transition amplitude from nothing to something, a tetrahedron or to something more. But this was the same as the amplitude. And in fact, you can understand this, the double role the amplitudes play as being actually also defining you the vacuum state. So how should you actually, so the question remains, how should you actually define the embedding map? And there's a formal trick to say, okay, if I embed a coarser geometry into a finer geometry, this map, you know, it looks a bit funny, But here you have a very fine geometry. I mean, if I would really discretize, it's hard to discretize because this seems to go from a larger radius to more to less radius. And if I would discretize it in equal length, it's basically the inverse thing which happens. So what we expect is that actually this part of the path integral defines you also the embedding. And basically, if really this projector property is satisfied, then what you do is, again, if you see this just as a radial evolution, is you put two radial evolutions together. If you go from coarser to finer, then you evaluate kind of this amplitude. And this would be automatically satisfied. And so there's basically these two points, which is a strategy, which one should do, is that one, in fact, has to put all these little things together. And what this means is that one should actually also really change basically what it means to have these discrete geometries. If you define these embeddings in a way which is useful, these embeddings will automatically organize your variables into kind of more relevant and less relevant variables. And they will end up to organize you automatically kind of a renormalization flow. The upshot is that at least you can hope to find basically some answers the process is basically that the calculations you hope are doable for homogeneous or for simple geometries. And these you can iteratively use to calculate for more and more complicated geometries. And actually, you also change this picture from having these local building blocks. You know, here I started with local building blocks. If you really do this coarse graining in higher dimensions and for non-topological series, you immediately get non-local couplings, which are very hard to control. However, if you organize your amplitudes in this way, you don't anymore apply this gluing stuff, but you just define these amplitudes which have to satisfy these consistency conditions. So actually, you only speak about the boundary in this way. And that's an interesting holographic aspect, naively, which still has to be explored. OK, so thank you for coming.